This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. A conservative business group's proposal might mean close to $1 billion a year for roads and bridges.
They said, would you help us come up with new ideas, ways that we could dedicate additional dollars to fixing the roads?
But it's complicated. Our political commentators talk about whether the legislature should skip summer vacation.
I think being in session actually gets in the way of fixing the roads and solving the budget.
We hear about Detroit civil rights activist James Boggs, who would be 100 this coming week.
Let me tell you something, Mary, and this is going to be hard for most of you to face. Most black folks are locked in the wood of racism. You don't see it as a challenge to you. You see it as an excuse for saying why you can't do nothing.
And after 3 years on the stateside, we wrap up our series, Artisans of Michigan, with a look at legendary Puyallup pottery.
You know, I love the fact that now you can go down Woodward Avenue and you can see, you know, tile work spanning over 100 years.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. I was reading a Detroit News article by Jonathan Osting, and in it, he explains that a business group is pitching an idea that could bring in nearly $1 billion a year, which could be spent on fixing the roads. The West Michigan Policy Forum proposes borrowing $10 billion through pension obligation bonds and put that money into the underfunded Michigan Public Schools employees' retirement system. That would then free up about $980 million a year. Joining us now is Jace Bolger. He's a former Speaker of the House who now works with the West Michigan Policy Forum. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lester. Good to be with you.
So take us step by step so we understand this. The state borrows $10 billion to put into the teachers' retirement fund. How does that free up the money?
Sure. Well, I'd back up even further to say the state has a massive unfunded liability to the teacher retirement fund. And so our concern is making sure that that's paid for, making sure that those teachers get the promises that they've been made, but also making sure that that promise, that pledge, is not kicked down the road so our kids and grandkids inherit that problem. So what this does is it would replace that unfunded liability with a bond, which does two things. It allows you to earn more and more return on that money because it's invested earlier, and it also secures that repayment plan. You have to make your bond payment. So it secures the repayment to ensure that it is paid off. So doing that, however, also frees up cash flow. And so it's not new money. What it does is it frees up the money that you were paying part of, the only part of the money. You still have to pay for the teacher pension system. But over the 30-year amortization, it'll free up an average of about almost $1 billion a year.
So we'll be making payments for a longer period, but we'll be freeing up this cash now. Is that what I'm hearing?
Only partly. That would be if you believe that the state is going to pay in the next 20 years. And the way that the state would have to do that in that projection, people will talk about a 2038 or 2039 payoff. The only way that works, effectively, every increase in the school aid fund goes to fund the pension system over the next, it ramps up over the next 10 years. So you'd have no teacher raises. You'd have no new money going to the classroom. And what we've seen historically, though, is that elected officials don't make those minimum payments. And over the Granholm era, when things got tight, those minimum payments weren't made to the tune of well over $1 billion. The bottom line is about $8 billion of the unfunded liability today comes from not making those payments. The point is, this plan would secure that repayment plan. So it's not kicked down the road. Make sure that those payments have to be made every year. And in doing that, it sets that 30-year amortization and make sure that it's paid off in that time.
Now, in the Detroit News piece, which I'm sure you've seen, Patrick Anderson of Anderson Consulting, who actually worked as a state deputy budget director during the Governor Engler's administration, was critical of your proposal. He indicated counting on pension investments to make up for the interest the state would be paying on the borrowed money is too much of a risk. He says there's no free lunch, and you can't save money by not paying your bills. What's your response to his criticism?
Well, clearly he's hired, and he's hired to oppose this by the Macomb ISD, as was reported in the MERS news service. But the bottom line is there is no free lunch. This is about making sure that that repayment schedule is secured. There's an imperfect analogy. The imperfect analogy would be like an individual who has a credit card payment that they're not meeting. They're barely making their minimum payment, and that just lasts forever. And that's kind of what we've been doing versus securing that to a fixed loan and making sure that that's paid off when you cut up the credit card. Where that analogy breaks down, though, and what he's looking at is you're not paying somebody else interest in this case. It's a matter of how much interest or investment return you can make by having that money invested. So it's not that extending the term means you're going to pay a bank more interest. You're not doing that. Instead, it's the bond it creates an inflow of cash that you invest for longer. So actually, it's going to cost less over the long term.
And right, you're talking about an average of 4%. But, you know, pension funds don't always perform according to predictions. What if they don't get an average of 4% return on that $10 billion?
You're right. That bond rate is about, we anticipate, about 4%. But over the long term, the market and these investments have produced greater than a 4% return. And so that is key. And so what it becomes is mitigating the risk. And I think one way to do that, if you invest in the market all at once, all on one day, you're at great risk because that market on one day or at one snapshot in time can go up or down dramatically. However, over time, it's shown that it will increase. And so that's what you do with your 401k. As you invest over time, and you could do that with these $10 billion. You could a dollar cost average and invest over a period of time so that you don't have the single snapshot. Pension obligation bonds have not worked for some entities, but that is because they've done it for the wrong reasons. They've done it because they can't make their payment. They've done it because they're in trouble and they must get a massive arbitrage, is what it's called, a massive investment over their interest payment. This would be for a different purpose, different reason, different assumptions, and therefore I think it's at much less risk.
So we've had this period of growth, expanded growth, for some time now, in fact, record time of a good economy. A lot of people think that, you know, we're on the cusp of a recession in a couple to 5 years. What happens if we do hit a recession and those bonds don't perform well?
Well, two things. Number one, we're talking about one quarter of the unfunded liability and putting a bond on one quarter of that. So you don't do the whole thing. You don't put all your eggs in one basket. The other, I would say that's a very good reason to extend that over time, to make sure that you're investing over time. Because if over the long haul we don't earn at least 4% interest, we've got much bigger problems because all of those projections that we're looking at, including the ones that you talked about earlier for 20 years, go way out the window. We've got to earn more than 4% over the long haul, or else we won't be able to fulfill these obligations without massive amounts of cash going in, which will, again, mean teachers don't get raises and there's no additional money for the classroom. So I think you have to recognize that risk, and then you have to mitigate it. And I think there are several strategies that could do that.
You know, one thing that occurred to me, if you're freeing up money that would otherwise be going to going from the school aid fund into the teacher's pension fund, well, shouldn't that money stay in the school aid fund?
And that was the purpose of this. The reason the West Michigan Policy Forum came forward is because we care about those unfunded liabilities. We want to make sure those teachers get paid, and we want to make sure that our kids and grandkids don't inherit that problem. However, we saw the Speaker Chatfield's goal, the desire, and effort to make sure that all the dollars that are paid at the pump, every dime that a taxpayer pays at the pump, goes to fix the roads. The question when you do that is, well, what about the school aid fund? Because the school aid fund gets money from that sales tax that we pay at the pump that does not go to roads. And so this frees up the cash to backfill that. That's the purpose. In fact, it frees up more cash than is needed to backfill for the sales tax, instead going to fix the roads. And so you could pay down the pension obligation even quicker by dedicating those additional resources. It's up to the legislature then. Do they turn that into additional dollars for the classroom, et cetera? So it does more than they needed to do to backfill putting the dollars you pay at the pump to fixing the roads.
The West Michigan Policy Forum presented the proposal to Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey and Speaker Lee Chatfield. What's been their response?
And the administration. I think the legislature, to their credit, is taking their time and looking at a wide variety of options. And so it was just information sharing. They had asked us to come forward with ideas. Again, the policy forum came at this and was focused on unfunded liabilities, not necessarily fixing the roads. But when they came to us, they said, would you help us come up with new ideas, ways that we could dedicate additional dollars to fixing the roads? And we saw this as a potential idea to do both. And so we came forward with that, but at this point, they're evaluating a lot of different ideas that they've come up with and others have presented to them.
Jace Bolger is with the business group West Michigan Policy Forum. The group proposed issuing pension obligation bonds for $10 billion to free up some money to use to fix the roads. Thanks for explaining your proposal to us.
Lester, good to be with you. Take care.
The last major outbreak of avian botulism on Lake Michigan was in 2016, when hundreds of dead birds washed up on shore. The bacterial disease has affected waterfowl like loons and mergansers in the Great Lakes for decades. But high water levels on the lakes are good news for the birds, at least temporarily. Stateside's Kay LaFond has more.
At Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore, a team of volunteers walk 32 miles of beach every week, from June through November. They're collecting data on avian botulism, a disease that paralyzes and kills waterfowl. It's caused by bacteria that produce a toxin in the water.
And so we document all the living birds and any dead or sick birds.
Mary Ellen Newport is out for her first walk of the season. She's a science teacher at Interlochen Center for the Arts. The mile-long section she's responsible for monitoring starts at the mouth of the Platte River. She has to cross it and go south.
Yeah, we usually waded across over that way, and we can get through, you know, it's like up to the hips, and now we're gonna do something different.
This year, water levels on Lake Michigan are so high that the river mouth is impassable on foot. So Newport is going to use a canoe.
There's another way to come in from the south side. But that turns into a four-mile hike. So this is the lazy person's way, is to take the canoe across.
High water levels are making botulism monitoring difficult this year. Some beaches have become bluffs, and dead birds can't wash up. And some sections of shoreline may not be monitored at all if volunteers can't access them. Avian botulism deaths have been down in Sleeping Bear Dunes since 2017. But overall, the disease has been worse on Lake Michigan in recent decades, ever since the invasion of quagga mussels. Newport says what's so disturbing about Lake Michigan's botulism problem is that it shows an ecosystem in upheaval.
The quaggas and the zebras have, like, undermined the entire food chain. So it's way more than avian botulism. It's really all about the health of the Great Lakes.
These filter-feeding mussels make the water clearer. Clearer water lets more sunlight in. Sunlight fuels the growth of cladophora, that annoying, smelly algae that washes up on the beach. And when the cladophora dies and decays, it creates the perfect environment for bacteria to produce the botulism toxin. High water levels are tough for monitoring, but they can actually be good for the birds. Scientists don't know the exact mechanism, but botulism outbreaks are linked to low water and warm temperatures. So Newport says this year's high water and colder lake temperatures are good news for the affected birds.
We should have a good summer. So I'm not unhappy about these high levels for the botulism count.
Unfortunately, it's probably temporary. Scientists expect climate change to keep warming the Great Lakes, which could increase bird deaths from botulism long term. I'm Kay LaFond.
Coming up, we wrap up our series, Artisans of Michigan, with a look at Puyallup pottery, in business since 1903. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Joe Hertler and the Rainbow Seekers are out with their latest album, Paper Castle. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia says the band is a staple of live music in Michigan. She spoke with vocalist Joe Hertler about why the band quit their day jobs to make music full-time, plus his obsession with rainbows.
The rainbow goes deep. I think the rainbow's something in the distance, but ultimately you can never get it.
I'm lost amidst my passions. It seems the dreams are endless. Someday I'll be brought back to the start.
You know, you achieve one goal, feel good for a little bit, but then it's just like the next thing. I think it's sort of a reminder to appreciate the grand mosaic of all things. Appreciate where you're at and to just behold the environment that you're in and keep moving forward through it. And, what worth is sunshine without the rain?
There's no people passing by through this place, always changing, but today there's only me and you. And I'm just passing through.
The record is titled Paper Castle, and I think I'm always kind of playing with themes of impermanence. I probably romanticize impermanence just in general a bit too much in my songwriting, but the title is an allusion to almost like nothing is totally sacred. Nothing is entirely ours for the keeping. That life is a gift and it's ultimately not ours to keep. And that the brevity of life is ultimately what gives it its value.
So 2 years ago, you were here when your album Pluto came out, and that release led you guys into a year of nearly constant touring, 150-plus shows. Was there, like, a standout moment for you guys during that time?
So the first support tour that we went on was with a band called Pigeons Playing Ping Pong. And they're like, a staple in the jam scene right now and have been around for, like, almost 12 years. And it's really, like, taken stride in the last couple of years. But I met their guitar player, Electric Forest, at, like, a super jam probably, like, 2 years ago. And we just became buds. And they took us on our first, like, real support tour that got everything started. And there was a particular moment on the last show of that tour. And I was just watching, we had played our set and it went well. And I was watching them and it was just like, a month had gone by. Become close friends with these guys and share a lot of experiences together. They were just super welcoming to us. And I think I was just, there was a moment of being like really excited about the next step in our own career and just grateful that we got to enjoy this. And it would go on to, basically be the catalyst for us getting booked on a bunch of other stuff. And they've just introduced us to so many people. And it's weird to think, like, without that tour, like, I don't know if we'd be a band. I think we would, but, like, we definitely wouldn't be in the position that we are now. And really grateful to them and their team just for giving us that opportunity. It's really been essential in our moving forward with all of this.
I said no.
Okay, so you ditched your day jobs and took this project full-time, and I should say the band includes guitarist Ryan Hodger, multi-instrumentalist Micah Bracken, saxophonist Aaron Stinson, and Ryan McMahon on drums. What has that been like for you guys?
It's really exciting. We've been doing this like 7 years now. We quit our jobs and went at it once before, and we really weren't ready at the time. Jumped off the diving board into a mostly empty swimming pool. And it was a little spooky. It was scary. And I think right now I feel thankful that, like, we've been able to persist this long. And I don't think we've ever compromised the art that we're making. It's always been, at least, what I can say it for the whole band. I genuinely think this is, like, the music we want to be making. We're proud of what we're making. And I'm really grateful that we finally can really focus on it, not just in, like, the touring standpoint, but it's so nice to be able to just, like, come home and work on tunes. I have a really cozy little studio in Lansing where I can just kind of sit for like 16 hours a day and mess around, make tunes. For whatever reason, I'm still inspired and spend a lot of time searching for songs, and there's ways to do that, mainly with, like, reading and traveling and just kind of absorbing those experiences and the emotions that come with them. But I'm also grateful that I keep getting to connect with the world and state how I feel through songwriting.
Under lengthening light, inside the breath of May, where I found you, cradled in petals, the colors cast to a windy day. And I was overjoyed by the throes of
So I know you have a great following throughout Michigan. You play tons of music festivals. But what's your experience on tour? What kind of response are you getting from the national scene?
Yeah, Michigan will always be number one in numbers. If that ever changes, I'd be really surprised. But it's really cool to just see. It's a great feeling to just feel like you're moving forward and to see this kind of steady growth that we have. I'm really grateful for it. And obviously, numbers can be kind of stressful at times. Like, it's something that just sucks to focus on too much. But at the end of the day, like, more and more people are coming. We've put in a lot of work doing support shows, opening for bigger bands over this, especially the last year. That was our goal for last year, was to, like, open for bands. And, we got those opportunities, and I think we did our best. And I believe very much that it's going to pay off in this coming year.
Joe Hertler and the Rainbow Seekers are on the music festival circuit this summer. Check out their tour dates at joehertler.com. Michigan Radio's latest Artisan of Michigan takes us to the east side of Detroit. We're at one of Detroit's oldest companies. Well, actually, these days, it's a nonprofit, but doing the same thing it has since the very early part of the 20th century. This is Puabic, the pottery and tile maker admired and loved by many in Michigan. Steve McBride is the executive director of Puabic.
Puabic was founded in 1903 by Mary Chase Perry, later Mary Chase Perry Stratton. She became really well known as a china painter, so she would kind of paint overglaze enamels on French china.
The person who later became her partner was at first her neighbor. Horace Calkins was a dentist who developed kilns to fire porcelain teeth for dentures.
And he found out that his neighbor was using one of his kilns to fire her china painting and realized, oh, here's a business opportunity.
He hired her to travel around and sell his kilns to other china painters and artists.
She learned a lot, and you know, at that point she was getting kind of bored with china painting and came back and said, hey, Horace, you want to go into business? And so they started a pottery.
First, in 1903, it was in Culkin's basement at his house in Brush Park. They quickly outgrew that space and moved to the current building, which was built in 1907. It's changed and expanded from there. One area of the current building is still being used exactly as it was 110 years ago. It houses a line shaft-driven clay mixer managed by Kevin Kwiatkowski. We took a look inside.
It's been here since 1909, since the first expansion of this building. We put in, to mix clay, we put in around 255 gallons of water and 2,300 pounds of dry material into this mixer.
That will make two big batches a day. When he's not filling the mixer or squeezing the excess water out of clay so it's usable, he's in the newest addition to the building where the clay is pressed.
Oh, that's what you mean by mallet.
Mm-hmm. Or pounded into molds. There are dozens and dozens of molds on the shelves. The master mold maker, Sherilyn Hunter, says there are others that are much older.
The originals are in the basement, locked away. The way we achieve the molds that you see here is to go down and get the original mold, press one, bring back its original detail, make new masters of that, and then multiples from there.
So if I own one of these really beautiful houses from the 1920s in Detroit and they've got Puabic tile everywhere, you probably could duplicate what they bought from the original mold.
Yeah, sometimes we can. We don't have all of the original molds because that's just probably a massive amount. But we have reproduced designs from finished installations, too.
Just sure, right. A few. You need one tile and you can start.
Yeah, I mean, you get an image and then, yeah, it's drawn, it's sculpted, it's made from scratch. And or sometimes, believe it or not, I do find the original mold in the basement and bring that up and start the process again.
The trick of making a mold is making sure the clay can be removed freely without tearing or damaging the image. That means something the designers make might not quite work when clay hits the mold. It's Hunter's job to make the mold work, but keep it as close to the original design as possible.
I don't claim to be an artist, but I like to do things with my hands. So this is the way to do it. And it's something different every time we get original designs. We have... We're problem solving constantly and trying to figure out how to create something. So it's fun. It's frustrating when you're trying to figure it out, but once it's all finished and you see the finished product, it's a really cool thing to see.
After drying, the clay is taken to the next step. If it's more intricate and needs a lot of color, it might be taken to Leo Kopak.
Today I'm hand painting, and this is a historic tile that Mary Chase Perry Stratton designed, so it's one of the few older ones that we carry on and keep doing. And this is a peacock, and what I'm doing is using this bulb glazing technique where we fill this little bottle up with glaze and there's a needle at the end of it, so you can kind of pinpoint where you're trying to get the glaze to go.
How long does it take to learn to do that well?
You know, you can jump into it and do it, but to do it well and like efficiently would be like the word to say, because like I don't know, when I first started doing this, it would take me, you know, hours and hours to do these, and I could still do it decently, but now I can kind of run through a bunch of them a lot faster, and still takes quite a while, and it's a lot more tedious of a glazing technique, but I've gotten better and better at it with time for sure.
It still takes a full day of work to do the glazing on six of these peacock tiles, which are 6 inches by 10 inches. If the dried clay is a vessel of some kind, it might simply be dipped into a glazing material. Jose Araniva Gomez finished grad school and has been working at Puabic for about a month.
What I'm doing, I'm lining the inside. It's what we do, we pour glaze inside, just pin it a couple of times so we get an even coat inside, and then just pour out the excess. And then for these mugs, we dip the top part, and then we just gonna let them dry for a few hours, and then we're gonna go back and glaze dip them, which means like we're just gonna hold them and then dip them into a different glaze.
These glazes are different than the ones used in 1907. Alex Thullen is in charge of developing today's glazes to match the colors associated with Puabic products. Why not use the original formulas?
Everything at that period of time was lead-based, as was, you know, every ceramic manufacturer. It was a really common, cheap, effective material to use. But, you know, times change, our understanding of health and safety changes. So all of the glazes that we use are new recipes, and they've been reformulated over the years so that we can achieve kind of the look and the feel and the warmth of those historic glazes, but using materials that are safe to work with by today's standards.
After glazing, the Puabic tiles or vessels are sent to the kilns. The kilns used to be brick-lined, labor-intensive, and didn't hold the heat all that well, which was fine in the winter, but during the summer, the temperature would get up to 120 degrees. Chris Mays says today, efficient kilns are a lot easier to deal with.
Once that program is saved in there, we really don't have to do much else other than kind of set it and forget it. They are all connected to the internet, so if anything goes wrong, we can monitor them from home.
So there's an app for that?
There is an app for that, that's for sure.
Let me ask you about how hot these get. I assume there's different peaks for different glazes.
What's the hottest? Well, the hottest that we go to is about 2,400 degrees Fahrenheit. And so for any ceramics that you do, you're generally not going to go much hotter than that when it comes to tiles, pottery, things like that.
Even with several additions to the 1907 building, Puabic still needs space. Across the street, Jefferson Avenue, we visit a building on City of Detroit Water Park property to watch Nicole Morocco at the Potter's Wheel.
This is the Puabic vessel making, and I just finished making one of our large harvest bowls. It's about 7 pounds of clay, and it ends up being about, 14 inches wide, I think? Oops. 15 inches wide is what they end up being.
Generous, right?
And Josh is working on cleaning some of our slip cast pieces.
Why are you guys over here all by yourselves?
Oh, our production needs are greater than the space we have across the street. So we rent this building from the city.
Well, it's kind of a cool building, firehouse.
It is, yeah. We're in an old fire station. It was built in 1914. The city never actually used it. By the time they finished it, it was too small for the trucks.
It had been designed for horse-drawn fire engines.
So they used it as storage, and then in the 60s, two sisters had a little arts and crafts school that they ran out of here, where kids would make little balsa wood boats and kites, and they had a little wood shop. Every once in a while, somebody will ring my bell and tell me they used to take classes here.
So this building's built for craft, it sounds like.
It was.
On the second floor of the fire station, Puabic employees are given space for a personal studio. Each person receives a certain amount of clay to pursue their own work. They have a contest with outside potters each year. There's an exhibit of the winners and the other entries in the main building. Puabic also offers classes, and it even has a couple of portable kilns to do demonstrations for the public at events. Steve McBride, the executive officer, says people in Michigan are fascinated with Puabic.
People, I think, just respond to, like, the maker aspect of it. I mean, that's, you know, Puabic was founded the same year as Ford Motor Company. So when, you know, Ford was inventing the assembly line and, like, you know, everything was speeding up. And I think, you know, the arts and crafts movement was reaching its peak in America at the time. And it was all about, like, you know, the hand of the maker and about kind of rediscovering the joy in, like, you know, handcraft. And I think that's always been the thing that people responded to. And I think today it's, you know, it's as strong as ever.
and Puabic has become a part of Michigan's legacy, especially in Detroit.
You know, I love the fact that now you can go down Woodward Avenue and you can see, you know, tile work spanning over 100 years, you know, from the Guardian Building, you know, the outside of that, to like in the DIA and the public library. But then, you know, going up into the 80s and you got the People Mover stations, and 2000 is Comerica Park. And just, you know, a couple of years ago, we did Little Caesars Arena and all the Q Line stations. So it's like this sense of, you know, it is a piece, we like to say it's part of the fabric of the city.
That's why, collectively, Puabic is our latest Artisan of Michigan. This is our last Artisan of Michigan. We've been bringing you this occasional series for 3 years now. It all began as a conversation between Mercedes Mejia and me, and Stateside's executive director, Joe Lindstroth, said, sure, do it. With a lot of logistical help from Lindsay Scullin, I got to visit blacksmiths, a broom squire, and a Native American black ash basket maker. I talked to a cobbler, a cooper, a clockmaker. You've heard woodworkers, a weaver, and metal workers on this program, a stonemason, a sign painter, a spoon carver, and a steampunk jewelry maker, craftspeople in stained glass and glass blowing, a chairmaker, a chopper motorcycle builder, and people who make guitars, mandolins, pipe organs, trumpets, drums, marimbas, and replicas of early pianos. There were others, 48 in all, and every one of them has made an indelible impression on me. I hope you've been impressed by some of their work as well. You can find all of the Artisans of Michigan by visiting michiganradio.org and search for Artisans. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come on Stateside, we'll talk about the life and legacy of Detroit thought leader James Boggs as we near the 100th anniversary of his birth. That's in 10 minutes. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This weekend, the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History kicks off a series of events marking the centennial of the birth of James Boggs. Boggs was a revered Detroit civil rights activist, an auto worker, and an author. He's best known for authoring The American Revolution, Pages from a Negro Worker's Notebook, published in 1963. Here's a clip from James Boggs from a documentary put up on YouTube by Flip Media.
You see, my father died when I was 8. So that was on my Mother's Day. And she always told me, baby, you do whatever make you happy in life. But she also said you ought to always try to do something that make the world a little better.
That is James Boggs. Joining us now is Stephen Ward. He's a professor and the director of undergraduate studies at the Department of Afro-American and African Studies at the University of Michigan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So why is James Boggs being celebrated?
James Boggs is being celebrated for a variety of reasons. One is that he and Grace Lee Boggs were, his wife and intellectual and political partner, were a powerful and generative team. In their lifetimes, they were both known together. But in the last couple of decades, Grace has become much more known than Jimmy. So we at the James and Grace Lee Boggs Center to Nurture Community Leadership, who are organizing the series of events, the James Boggs 100, want to use his centenary as an opportunity to revisit him and to reestablish him and Grace together as this partnership, who are important to Detroit history, and we think also are important to contemporary thinking about important social change that we need.
He was a great thinker of the time in Detroit, but I want to talk about his blue-collar background for a second. He was an auto worker at a time when black workers were given the worst jobs for the least pay. How did that shape his approach to civil rights?
It shaped his approach to civil rights. It shaped his approach to social change more broadly, to revolutionary change, which he and Grace were very much, that was the foundation and the central object of their thinking and their activism. So he became an auto worker in 1940. He was born in Marion Junction in 1919, Marion Junction, Alabama, went to school in Bessemer, Alabama, and right after graduating from high school in 1937, he came to Detroit as some of his family members and other people from his community, like many other communities throughout the South, had done, in search of work in the auto industry. He didn't find it at that point in 37, still in the Depression, but by 1940, he had left and come back to the city. He began working at Chrysler Jefferson, where he would work for 28 years. And so at that moment in 1940, he was in the that was at the moment of the power of the UAW and industrial unionism. And so being in the plant and being in the union at that time shaped his thinking about the power of workers, but also about how changes within in production really helped to or shaping broader context for changes in society overall.
And even at that time, even though there was talk about sisterhood and brotherhood within the union, there was a divide there, a racial divide within the union itself.
Absolutely, absolutely. He was part of the DAC, the Discrimination Action Committee, which is an organization that the Detroit branch of the NAACP created in conjunction with black workers in the union. And this organization, the DAC, was, as they called it, breaking up discrimination in the restaurants and other establishments up and down Woodward Avenue. So they were doing the type of activism that we came to know as part of the civil rights movement, direct action, so forth, in the 40s. So yeah, he was very much aware through experience and what he observed and thought about and wrote about the distinction between black and white workers and the need to not just gloss over those distinctions.
We've got a clip from James Boggs here, again from a short documentary by Flip Media.
Our parents told us, you have to make a way out of no way. You don't hear people tell folks that now. All of us go around and say, I can't do nothing because this old racist society. I can't do nothing because this old capitalist society. I can't wait because these white folks around here messing with me. I can't do this, I can't. So that the day most of us are already frozen in lock. Yeah. Let me tell you something, and this is going to be hard for most of you to face. Most black folks are locked in the wood of racism. You don't see it as a challenge to you. You see it as an excuse for saying why you can't do nothing. That's the most devastating, damaging thing that's happened to us. We have to see it as a challenge to take us to another plateau.
Now, that statement about African-Americans rejecting the idea that they cannot do anything because they are oppressed, it's not exactly the same thing we hear from today's thought leaders, such as Ta-Nehisi Coates, who makes the argument that the structure of racism is designed to oppress people of color in perpetuity. Now, those arguments don't necessarily contradict each other, but they certainly are from different perspectives. What's been the evolution of thinking between the time of James Boggs and today's big thinkers such as Coates?
You're right. There are some distinctions and different approaches and the type of thinking that Ta-Nehisi Coates and James Boggs represent. Jimmy, as many people called him, believed ideas were really important. He made a statement in 1993, just a month or so before he passed. I was speaking to young activists in an organization called SOSAD, which is an acronym, stands for Save Our Sons and Daughters, which was an organization confronting youth violence in the late 80s and early 90s. In May of 93, a couple of months before his passing, he told this group that, I believe ideas are matters of life and death, and people ought to struggle over them. And that reflects the importance he attributed to ideas. And one of his hallmarks of his thinking was what he identified as thinking dialectically, which for him and Grace meant that we have to recognize that reality is constantly changing. And as reality changes, our ideas have to change. And ideas which were powerful at one point may not be so later as other circumstances and as reality changes. And so the clip that you just played reflects that. He, of course, was not saying that racism had not been an impediment to black people and other people of color, but he was saying that the ways in which we struggle against racism, say in the 1940s or 50s, and the frameworks and ideas and the actions that we devise in those moments, we shouldn't expect those to remain appropriate in the 60s or in the 80s. When he was making that statement.
James and Grace Lee Boggs were married for like 40 years.
Yes.
They were, as you said, partners and activists together. And in fact, I saw a documentary about her, and throughout their married life, they're always in those meetings together. She was a little quieter than he was, but she was powerful when she did speak. Tell me about that relationship.
So many people notice that they're two very different people, her being a Chinese-American, raised in a middle-class family. She was born in Providence, Rhode Island, but raised in New York. Whereas Jimmy is an African-American born in the rural South. Grace was formally educated. She earned an undergraduate degree from Barnard College and then a PhD in philosophy from Bryn Mawr in 1940, which is that same moment when Jimmy began working in the auto industry and became a union activist. So he's high school educated, but not formally educated in the way that Grace was. So there are two very different types of racial and ethnic backgrounds, different types of intellectuals, but they were complementary as well. They learned from and with each other. So I mean, people who worked with them, knew them, were in meetings where they fought. Jimmy and Grace would disagree with each other, but they saw that they were learning and grappling with ideas, devising strategies, and working together and evolving to new places together.
As you mentioned, she attained a lot more fame than James did while he was alive. Given that, you know, what is James Boggs' legacy in Detroit and the civil rights movement today because of Grace Lee Boggs?
So his legacy for Detroit, for the civil rights movement, but for revolutionary thought more broadly, is someone who was constantly questioning and developing new ideas and engaging in organizations and in struggles. And as he described it, struggle is social practice. He said, so when you engage in struggles, you learn from those. And whether you win or lose, that particular struggle is, of course, important, but ultimately it's not the only thing, because you learn from those struggles, you revise and ideas, devise new ideas, new strategies, and so forth. And another hallmark of his thinking came to be the importance of community building and the relationships that we have to each other and to the earth. And in our contemporary world, those two questions of how we relate to each other, how we relate to the earth, to nature, are, as he said, life and death questions for the survival, really, of the species.
Now, to your point about what's happening at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit, marking the centennial of James Boggs' birth, what's on tap? What are we going to see?
We will see and hear many things. So Sunday is their large kickoff event at the Wright Museum at 2 o'clock. We'll have two conversations, one on James Boggs' legacy, one on his lineage. Legacy meaning the ideas and things that he left and created, the legacy and the ways in which we can see those playing out today, or people engaging, picking up some of those questions, even if not directly related to him. We'll have a range of speakers, people who knew him. And then after the museum, we'll have a celebration with dinner and birthday cake and more music and performances at the Cass Corridor Commons.
So that's the kickoff, but there's a whole week marking the birth of James Boggs.
Yes, and we'll invite people to please go to the website, jb100.org, to see all of the events that will be happening over the next week and a half.
Stephen Ward is a professor with the University of Michigan's Department of Afro-American and African Studies. We've been talking about James Boggs and the celebration of his 100th anniversary of his birth. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
The Michigan legislature is getting ready for a summer break beginning with the 4th of July weekend. Business leaders and the governor are saying, hold up there, we need to find a way to fix the roads before you take off. Here to talk about that are our political commentators. Ken Sikkema is a senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader of the state Senate. And this week, Coleman Young II joins us. He's a former Democratic member of the state Senate. Welcome to the program, Coleman.
Hey, always a pleasure to be with you.
It seems we've heard this sort of political meme before. How can you go on vacation when there's still the people's work to do? Ken, what do you think of that this time?
Well, saying that the legislature's on vacation is a bit of an exaggeration, because being in session is really only part of the job, and they're not taking a vacation from the other parts of the job. And the other thing is, if you really want to get serious about fixing the roads and getting closure on the budget, I don't think you want the legislature in session. I mean, you know, you're dealing with a handful of legislators, particularly the leadership, and, you know, you want their time and energy focused on these big issues, not sort of dealing with, you know, legislators milling around in session without much to do. So I think being in session actually gets in the way of fixing the roads and solving the budget.
Coleman, are these business groups and the governor just using a political ploy, or is this call to fix the roads before taking any time of break a sincere concern and request?
It's a totally sincere request. Listen, they need to stay there as long as it takes. Monday, Tuesday, Easter Sunday, Christmas, it doesn't matter. However long until the end of the apocalypse shows up, they need to work on this issue and get this done. There are too many people whose lives are at risk because the roads are not safe. You have people who are blowing out their tires and going 6 miles an hour. You have bridges that are falling apart. You have roads that are not safe. This is something that needs to be done, and we are
hurting our children's future by taking away money from the education fund in order to pay for this. And this is one of those issues where you're going to have to bite the bullet and you're going to have to raise the revenue necessary in order to get this done and change the Act 51 formula to make sure that it's based on road usage, not based on where you live, rural or city.
The business groups want a multi-year investment of billions of new dollars for roads and bridges. The Republicans are looking at shuffling some money around for the most part at this point, and they're certainly not considering a 45-cent per gallon tax as the governor has proposed. Ken, are the business groups going to get something they'll be happy with?
Well, this will take new revenue. There's just no question about it. You're going to have to find new revenue, meaning raising taxes, whether you get to 45 cents or not, I guess is still debatable. But in order to solve this problem in a sustainable fashion, it's going to take substantial new revenue, and the business groups have acknowledged that, and I think the legislature, frankly, understands it as well.
Coleman, what's the best way to raise billions of new dollars for roads and bridges?
Well, listen, you're going to have to raise new revenue here. I mean, I agree with Senator Sikkema here. You can't do this with the current money available. You're going to have to raise new revenue. You're going to have to change Act 51, like I said earlier. You're also going to have to make sure that you look at the materials you use to build the roads, particularly whether that would be rubber, whether that would be hempcrete or other such materials, that those roads last longer. Those are things that you're going to have to look at a holistic approach. I would even say for the city, particularly looking at allowing whether or asking the question to the public of whether or not locals should have a smaller rate, but some form of a local gas tax that they could issue just for the issue of fixing the roads in the city because of its size.
Some of them have millages already. But back to that question of how do you raise billions of new dollars? What's the best way, Coleman?
Well, no. Listen, no one likes the gasoline tax, but I think that's the only way you're going to have to do it for now. You can't rely on the federal government and what they have available because that's woefully underfunded. You know what I mean? You're going to have to. I mean, I don't like this. I don't think anyone likes doing this. And we all know that the gas tax can be regressive because it's hitting everybody here. But we've got to have roads that actually work, that are actually drivable, safe, and right now we just don't have that.
Let's look at another topic here. MLive requested that all state legislators provide information about their financial interests to the media and the public. Of the 148 members of both houses, 10 legislators provided that information. Michigan is only one of two states that do not require legislators and the governor to provide financial disclosure. Ken, what do you think of this situation? Is disclosure important?
No, I don't think it is. I'm really agnostic about requiring financial disclosure and sort of, I guess, mildly opposed, because I just don't think it really matters. I mean, I'm sort of operating under the theory that legislation should only be enacted if it solves a problem, and I don't think there's much there. I mean, we have it at the federal level, and about the only thing that happens is every year after these things are filed is there's an article about who's the richest member of Congress and who's the poorest, and that's about it. So I'm kind of mildly opposed because I don't think it accomplishes much.
How do we know if our legislator might have a conflict of interest on something he or she votes for?
You know, my experience, 20 years in the legislature, leadership in both the House and the Senate, that conflict of interest is simply not an issue. When legislators get in trouble, it's not over a conflict of interest. It's really over fundraising and, management of staff and that sort of thing. And there are rules in both the House and the Senate. They're generally complied with about reclusing yourself, not voting if there's a conflict of interest. I think this is much to do about nothing.
Coleman, how much, if any, financial information should an elected official disclose?
Listen, let me say this for the record. I do not like filing my campaign finance report. I don't like it, but I understand that we need to do it because transparency is the best sunshine. And when you're running for office, people need to know where your interests lie, if they lie with yourself or if they lie with them. And they need to know if you have confidence in it. Now, maybe when Ken was serving, they had a higher code or standard where conflict of interest was not a problem. When I was up there, it was a problem quite a bit. And so I personally feel in order for us to have the best government, the most honest government, the most transparent government, the government that the citizens want and deserve, we need to provide this information. And I think that 10 out of the, I forgot the number that you put out there, but over 140, if I'm not mistaken, is outrageous and pathetic. We need to be able to provide this for the sake of the state and the republic.
Coleman Young II is a former Democratic state senator. Ken Sikkema is a former Republican majority leader of the Senate. Thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.